It's very nice to be. Thank you very much for the invitation. It's very nice to be back. I don't recognize the building anymore. I didn't recognize the orientation. I didn't even recognize the faculty members here anymore. But it's very nice to be back. So Shamil has asked me to summarize the recent developments in hydraulic flux compactification. And what I would like to do is to tell you why I'm excited about this type of compactifications, what is what still needs to be done, what has been achieved in hydraulic flux compactifications. So let me call it hydraulic flux compactifications. Discovery of Calabi-Yau compactifications in the mid-80s, people have tried to, synthesists have tried to make contact with the MSSM and grand unified theories. This turned out to be a very difficult question, mainly because of two reasons. Number one, many times exotic particles, the particle content doesn't work out. Appear along the way, which means particles that do not fit into the standard model of elementary particles. And we've made progress in recent times. I will talk about this a little bit. Second, in conventional Calabi-Yau compactifications, what we see is that there are many model fields that cannot be stabilized. And for this purpose, what introduces flux compactifications. And we will see that flux compactifications in principle stabilize model fields in the hydraulic context as well. So Calabi-Yau compactifications give us more of this. Which is one of the main motivations for studying hydraulic flux compactifications. I'll mainly focus on point two, but I cannot resist to make some comments on point one, because I think there are some recent developments are rather exciting in this direction. So let me start, let me give you an overview of what I would like to say. First of all, I'll talk about point one, so particle content and connection to the standard model. So let me call this hunting for the standard model. Then I will talk about hydraulic flux compactifications. The point of view that I would mainly like to use is the low energy effective action approach. I know that Alan Adams has given recently a talk on the linear single model approach, which I will not emphasize that much, but it's a very, very exciting approach that we are pursuing as well. The next point that I would like to saw in this hydraulic flux compactification from the supergravity point of view, I would like to, number one, first review what are the torsional constraints. Second, I would like to show you what has been called what are smooth solutions of this torsional constraint, something that is called the FSY geometries, which stands for full Strominger and Yau geometries. Then I would like to show you that such geometries have an interesting pattern of gauge symmetry breaking. Then we will talk, which is some work in progress with Tseng and Yao about definitions. How do we define moduli fields in hydraulic flux compactifications? How can we stabilize moduli fields? So the very definition of a moduli field in a hydraulic flux compactification needs to be defined. Then I will talk about ways how to construct such models. So I will present one particular model, but more models follow from so-called geometric transitions. Next point I would like to emphasize are possible manifolds are classified in terms of torsion classes. And I don't think that I will get into it, but there has been some work in direction cosmology, so we would like to, of course, see how can we observe something like this. There has been some developments in cosmology, inflation, and cosmic string in the context of federalic theories. So, but I don't think I will get to this point. So cosmology. Okay, so let me start with point number one, hunting for the standard model of elementary particles. So traditionally people have been looking for the standard model of elementary particles in the context of the heterotic theory. However, recent developments in string dualities allow us to look for it in the context of type 2 theories. And let me show you, briefly mention what the main developments in the context of type 2 theories are. I will mention some names that come to mind in connection to the developments, but it's by far not the complete list, so I apologize if I kind of don't mention all people working in the subject. So let me go to point number one. So in type 2 theories, so let me emphasize first type 2 theories. In type 2 theories, the developments that have been taking place are, number one, intersecting brainwork models. So names that come to mind are Cvetic, Ranga, work by Gary Shew, work of the Munich group, and so on. So these are the main names that come to mind. In intersecting brain world models, what we observe are mainly what people have considered are orbifolds, like for example T6 mod C2 times C2. And many times in these theories, what appears are exotic particles. So, and what we observe is both types of particles, chiral exotic and non-chiral exotics. The problems are always the chiral exotics because we cannot get rid of them through gauge symmetry, through the breaking of gauge symmetry. So such models contain chiral exotics. And many times this type of models contain gauge groups that are extended gauge groups. They are not just the standard model gauge groups, but there is some additional stuff that comes with it. Of course, if you are an optimist, you can say, wow, we discovered new physics because once the LHC turns on, you observe these new particles, you observe something new. Or you can be the pessimist and say, whoa, this doesn't work. So it depends now from the physics, LHC physics, to see what is the right perspective, either it works or it doesn't. Then a second approach in the context of type 2 theories.
There's not really a way to get rid of the
chiral
exotics, is there?
Or, I don't think so, no. So from point number B, so the second approach is T3 brains have singularities. An approach initiated by Hermann Gerlinde and Weinhold. So what these guys considered is they considered a D3 brain that is sitting in a Calabi-Yau with a singularity. one at the face of three singular, one at the face of surface. So the distribution is at the CP scale. And in this type of models, what they have observed is an extended Higgs sector. Again, it depends now. It depends on what your point of view is. Either we discover more Higgs particles than the standard model has, or we don't. So it depends now what we see in the LHC. So let me know, though. Yes?
I know this is away from the line of your talk, but mm-hmm. It seems like these two should be mirror. I mean, if I take this thing and I plot mirror symmetry, can we get something with 6 minutes? Intersecting 6 minutes.
Yes.
Do you know if there are ways to reason up so you get the same features on the other models?
I'm not sure. You mean mapping this not to intersecting deeper models? I'm not sure about that. No, I don't know. I'm going more for the traditional approach. No, I just wanted to mention what the positive points are, what the negative points are, as opposed to what I'm going to focus now, which is the heterodic theory. So, as I say, what I would like to do is to focus on the heterodic theory. So I'll go for a more traditional approach. Well, traditional, I'm going for the weakly coupled and the strongly coupled theory, which is not so traditional. And some recent results that I consider very exciting come from the Penn group. So names that come to mind are Ruth Olrud, Ron Banagi, Vincent Bouchard. So what these guys have been able to do is to construct a particular model which exactly reproduces the features of the standard model. So let me show you what these particular properties are. First of all, what they found is, number one, so they considered, let me say first, what they considered is a Calabi-Yau compactification. Of the heterodic theory, both at weak and strong coupling. And what they considered is a Calabi-Yau that is a very particular Calabi-Yau. It's a Calabi-Yau that is an elliptically fibered Calabi-Yau over a depth of surface. And what they found is the following. They found, number one, standard model gauge group. Number two, they found a model where there are no chiral, no exotics, let me not say chiral, no exotics. Number three, they found a model where there's exactly the right Higgs particle content, so right Higgs particle content. Is a gauge symmetry pattern that breaks the E8, so they do have E8 symmetry of the heterodic string, which is broken down by an SU4 gauge instanton, which is sitting on the Calabi-Yau, to SU4 plus SO10. SO10 is a very interesting group because with SO10 you can embed, in SO10 you can find chiral neutrinos. And what it means is you can explain, for example, the fact that massive neutrinos have been observed in nature, and you can embed this into SO10, which is something rather interesting. The drawback of this approach is that they consider conventional Calabi-Yau compactifications. So even though they are able to reproduce some rather interesting properties of the standard model, they are not able to make for us predictions. They are not able to tell us what the masses of the particles are. They are not able to tell us anything about cosmological constant. The reason is that they are forgetting about the back reaction. They're considering just conventional Calabi-Yau compactifications. So the idea, what I consider an interesting direction for the future, is to look at models that have similar patterns, which are elliptically fired manifolds over the theta surface, but where the back reaction is taken into account, alias torsional background of this type, where we can then hope to fix the coupling constant and have, again, a particle content that is very similar to the particle content of the standard model.
The back reaction of what?
The H. Okay. They don't consider torsion whatsoever. They have just conventional Calabi-Yau magnification.
Do you think they have it fixed a module?
Not at all. They do have right particle content, no modally fixed at all.
But they sometimes talk about some models where they have an anti-5 range involved. Is that this too? Is that the same thing you're talking about here?
Sometimes they do have 5 frames. In the strongly coupled theory, they do have 5 frames. In the weakly coupled theory, they don't have 5 frames because you do not want to have 5 frames on the visible boundary.
Well, I meant an anti-5 frame. Like they have some problems with stability conditions, and then they add an anti-5 frame. I'm raising the question if they do talk about the Planck-like potential.
As I say, in some models they do have 5 frames, in some they don't. I consider models where there are no 5 frames in the theory, which are the ones that I will consider later on, that I will
list. No 5 frames or anti-5 frames?
No 5 frames or anti-5 frames, and it's possible to do that, because if you do include 5 frames, then of course you do have more modally fields, you need to fix positions of the 5 frames. But there is a way to, in principle they include just 5 frames, to solve the hydraulic Bianchi identity. But you, in principle, don't need this if you don't embed the spin connection into the gauge connection.
Just to be clear, when you say there are no exotics, I mean, it still has, it's not just a standard model, it still has supersymmetry and it has these moduli. So it's just some MSSM?
Yes.
And the MSSM fields include the moduli, or those are, it's...
No.
So there are extra light scalars in this theory as well.
But they're not chiral.
Chiral exotic.
Yes.
Okay.
They still have, of course, the modeling fields. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. Okay. So let me. There's a race here. But I consider this kind of very good news because it really took a long time. It was in the mid-80s when people discovered Calabi-Yau compactification. And since the mid-80s, people were saying, well, I don't see exactly the right particle content of the standard model. And it's really, I don't know how many years later, that people come up with a model where they say, I exactly have the right particle content as the standard model, which I think is very exciting news. So let me talk. My goal is to introduce you to flex compactifications of the hydraulic string. Of course, we are not at the point where I can say, okay, I have a flex compactification which exactly has such features. Right now we're dealing with toy models. The goal is to deal later on with models which are more complicated, which have phenomenologically interesting properties. So let me introduce you to flex compactifications. And again, there are many names associated with it. I don't know whether I should kind of find all those names. So the story started with Strominger in the mid-80s. And then the story was revisited. So in the mid-80s, people forgot more or less about this compactification because they turned out to be mathematically, the mathematics of this type of manifolds, non-Calabi-Yau manifolds, distortion are, it's much more complicated than what you know from ordinary Calabi-Yau compactifications. So people just forgot about it until they realized, well, flux compactifications can stabilize modeling fields for us. So this story was forgotten since the mid-80s. It came back a little bit later on, work with Dasgupta. Names that come to mind is also Tokushkin, Goldstein, then we have done some work with Yao, same, and let me just put that because there's a large number of names. Well, let me not forget maybe the list too. So this. So let me start revealing for you. So what is a torsional background? A torsional background satisfies some constraints. that come from supersymmetry. So let me, for those of you who don't know about this, review what orthogonal constraint is. Right now, I'm going to consider supersymmetric solutions, absolutely. But it's a very important and interesting question, how to break supersymmetry in those models, how to construct metastable vacua, something along those directions is not known whatsoever. So orthogonal constraints. And you will see later on why supersymmetric solutions are even important, I would say, to define model diffuse for this series. So so as I was saying, so what we do have in torsional manifolds, so once we take flux, so the hydraulic theory does have a Navier-Schwarz field, a three-form field that is the Navier-Schwarz spectrum, which plays the role of torsion. So H and S of the hydraulic. And as I said a moment ago, the resulting manifolds are no longer Calabi-Yau manifolds, but are non-Keller manifolds. With torsion. So let me quickly remind you. So that we are on common grounds, but the constraints are on the background geometry and on the H field, because these are the constraints that we have to satisfy if we would like to construct particular hydraulic backgrounds. So first of all, we know that entanglements, the hydraulic theory, has got the following terms in the low energy effective action. I'm working here in the spring frame. And where this H is the three-point tensor field, which contains a transformance term. This is omega of A that I'm writing down here. Where A is the non-Abelian gauge field. This F is the field strength to corresponding to this gauge field. I will take the field strength to be Hermitian. So physicists consider the Hermitian version, mathematicians consider the anti-Hermitian version. When you mix both, then there is completely a disaster. Some papers are completely wrong because some people take mathematics conventions when working with physics conventions. So, and things like Iwasawa is a solution, for example, result when you mix up both conditions. So, so I consider here this field to be Hermitian. This, the full action, so I wrote down just the bosonic content of the theory, but of course the full action also contains fermions, and the theory is invariant in a set of supersymmetry transformations. So let me write down a figure of supersymmetry transformations. So you can see from where our torsional constraints come. First of all, we do have the supersymmetry transformation for the Gravikino, which takes the following form. Eta is a 10-dimensional Mariar and a Weiss spinner. Then we do have the supersymmetry transformation for a Bigatino. And then the supersymmetry transformation for a Guarino. A supersymmetric configuration is, of course, a configuration that satisfies the delta of our fermions. It's equal to zero. So, and what we can do is, of course, then solve, look for those conditions here. What we have to do then is to decompose our 10-dimensional quantities into a 4 plus 6 split. And what we can do then is to write down in terms of the spinors, once we find covariant quantum spinors and the background geometry that satisfies this, we can construct the quantities that will characterize our geometry. Namely, what we have is an Hermitian form J. So we do, so such manifolds have an Hermitian form J. Which is related to the metric, so I'll be interested in manifolds that are complex manifolds, which is related to the metric in this way here. And the manifolds have a holomorphic freeform. For the case that the manifold is Keeler, of course, this J corresponds to the Keeler form, and Tj is closed. However, this doesn't have to be the case for the heterotic compactification that I'm considering here. So let me just show you what the differences are. So this, once I do have these two quantities, my Hermitian form and my holomorphic free form, I can completely characterize my geometry, and I can determine the edge field and the dilaton in terms of these two quantities. So let me write down, let me just compare what we know for ordinary Calabi-Yau compactifications and non-Keeler manifold distortion. So what we know for Calabi-Yau manifolds, we know that we can define a Keeler form that is closed. Similarly, for what happens for the, so this is the so-called Keeler form, what happens for non-Keeler manifolds distortion is that this form here, J, is not closed, but it satisfies a condition that is called, it's a conformally balanced condition, which looks in the following way. So this follows from supersymmetry. The manifold has to be conformally balanced. Of course, I will mention in a moment that this omega here, which is the holomorphic freeform, is that D is equal to zero. So what we see from here is that all manifolds that are Keeler are conformally balanced, but not the other way around. Also, for this manifold, we can define the holomorphic freeform, which is closed. Same thing happens for the case of non-Keeler manifolds. For the Calabi-Yau compactification, the tensor field is equal to zero, something that is not the case for non-Keeler manifold distortion, where this H field is related to the emission from J.
Now, did you really mean zero or just cohomologically trivial?
Here?
In the Calabi-Yau case, if you don't do the standard embedding, don't you get H, but
it's I'm doing the standard embedding. So for me, Calabi-Yau is just standard embedding like people did in the 80s point. Okay? And I know that for Calabi-Yau compactifications, we know that the phi is constant. While the case for non-Keeler manifolds with torsion, this phi is no constant, it's no longer constant, but it's related to the norm of the holomorphic freeform. So then there is the last thing that follows from supersymmetry, which is my gauge field, which happens to be the case both for Calabi-Yau compactifications and for non-Keeler manifolds, which follows from the last condition that I do have here for the Gluino, is that it's called the Hermitian-Young-Mitz condition. Which tells us that f to 0 part of f equal to 0 to part of f has to be equal to 0, and that F has to be primitive. So let me erase over here. One condition, so these are the conditions that follow from supersymmetry, but then there is one additional condition that imposes very, very strong constraints on the allowed geometries, which is the hadronic anomaly cancellation condition. We'll see later on how this restricts and excludes many internal geometries, and further, the anomaly cancellation condition was the one that Yao and Fu used to show the existence of solutions to distortional backgrounds. So it's in principle the equation that gives you the solution for the dilaton field, and they were able at the beginning of this year to show that this equation does actually have a solution.
So, can I ask a question about that?
Yes.
One thing that Alan emphasized, you said you weren't going to discuss the linear models, which is reasonable, but one point that he made is that that condition forces the manifold to be, generically forces the manifold to be string scale. And so, although you obviously learn a lot from working out the supergravity equations, in the end, to have them be self-consistent, it better be true that you can somehow tune the volume to be large.
What we have right now is a fiber that is small. The manifold itself is large, but the fiber is small.
The fiber in the
up there is something? No. What we have. Well, okay. I still didn't introduce you to the particular type of manifold that I have. Okay. What I will have is a K3 IT2 fiber over K3, and what I will see is that it is too small.
Uh-huh. What makes the K3? You said the K3 base is big.
Mm-hmm.
What makes that big?
I can take it to be big. So there is no problem whatsoever.
Okay.
Yeah. So, but what is what you were worried about?
Well, the question is just whether the supergravity is in fact a self-consistent approximation scheme for the solutions that you define, and it may well be that you can tune something to.
Mm-hmm. Let me leave it at that point that this is as best as I know right now how to deal with it. So linear singles, it's a more complicated approach. So, but we're looking into that approach as well. So you can use it to define model fields, which are marginal deformations of the conformal field theory, but the conformal field theories itself are not well enough understood, so there is still a lot of amount of work to do in this direction. So let me put it, it's a starting point here.
Just to clarify, even if you can take the base to be as big as you like, then is there any reason to think there's a controlled supergravity approximation of the fiber is forced to be small?
Well, the fiber to be small, I kind of don't have any comment on this. So it's right now I'm taking the supergravity approximation to be the best we can do right now. So it's one of the motivations to look at the single model approach, but otherwise that's right now the best we can do. Look at the file.
So, these are the magnifications shown in the structure. These are complex magnifications in the structure.
Yes. These are complex manifolds, yes.
And so H is of type 2-1 and 1-2?
Well, it depends whether you would like to break some symmetry or not. So that's a good point. So you can break some symmetry if you turn on a 0 component, add 2, and the other components will break some symmetry. So it depends now. But it's a very good question. So as I was saying, so the last condition that we that imposes very strong constraints on the internal geometry is anomaly cancellation. Anomaly cancellation tells us that the BH, which through the equations that I wrote down over there, can be written as 2i del del bar j, is equal to, as I found over 4, trace of r which r minus trace of f which f. And as I say, this we will see later on that this equation will put strong constraints on our background and will determine for us the dilaton field. One thing that we see from here is that if you would like to have a non-vanishing edge field, of course you can choose the standard embedding where we identified this term, well, this term here, because otherwise our tensor field, our 3 from tensor field is equal to 0. So now standard embedding is allowed in this type of covariant applications, which is good because, as I say, later on we will see that if we don't do the standard embedding, we arrive at very, very interesting gauge symmetry breaking patterns. So what I would like to do next is to show you, so I do have these equations here that follow from supersymmetry. I do have this equation there that imposes anomaly cancellation. What I would like to do is to show you to construct orbifold extenders were constructed some time ago. It's work that we've done in collaboration with Keshav Dasgupta and a number of other collaborators. What I would like to show you now is a smooth solution that we constructed with so goal is now to construct which is work in collaboration with Fu, Cheng and Yao. So the manifold that we would like to consider, let's make an ANDRAD. So the 10-dimensional manifold that we would like to, the 6-dimensional, excuse me, manifold that I would like to consider is, let me write this first. So it's a P2 bundle over a Calabi-Yau twofold space. We call this dA square plus dz plus alpha of y. Tell you what orientation is number one. Where this y denotes the coordinates of the 4-dimensional base. I would like to take the 4-dimensional base to be a Calabi-Yau twofold, which means I do have two possibilities, either it's K3 or it's T4. And we will see that anomaly cancellation condition will eliminate T4 as a base. Yeah.
Just to follow up on this question. In this case, since there's no z dependence in the metric, is even though the torus is small, that super rally still be.
There's no z
dependence in the metric, which in the direction it's small, because it's really small. So,
yes.
Super gravity then be good because of that.
In super gravity, what?
Why might super gravity approximation still be good because of that? Yeah, why did the one that's in the effect?
Get winding mode and takes away from
it. Yeah, that's true.
Of this metric, I don't know. We haven't looked into that. So let me call this. So as I say, regarding the question of the bundle being small of size alpha prime, I don't have anything new to say. So let me call this coordinate theta. Let me see if I can get a larger piece of chalk. And so this z denotes the torus coordinate. This alpha is a one form that depends just on the base coordinates. And let me introduce the notation I already indicated over there, because I'm going to be needing it in a moment. Theta is equal to dz plus alpha of y. And let me introduce a form, d theta, which I will call omega, which is a two form that can have a set dual part, which is a zero form, plus an anti-set dual part, which is a one form. So I'm going to be needing it this later on. So in terms of these quantities that I introduced here, I can construct the Hermitian form and the holomorphic free form of my internal manifold. So let me show you how which are the quantities that characterize my geometry. So let me show you how the Hermitian form. Thank you. of my manifold looks like. So first of all, the Hermitian form J of the entire six-dimensional manifold can be constructed in terms of my dilaton multiplied by JS. So let me denote JS are the, since I'm considering our Calabi-Yau two-fold base, JS is the perpendicular form, JS plus I over 2 theta, which theta bar, where the theta is the theta that I introduced there. It's in general complex. And what we can show is that, so it's just an easy calculation, to just plug it in. So it's to show that the sign that here satisfies that the manifold is conformally balanced. The manifold, but there is one constraint that has to be satisfied, namely that the omega that I introduced there, theta is d theta is equal to omega, has to be primitive with respect to the base. So it's a really a one-line calculation inserting this into this equation here. Furthermore, I can construct my holomorphic free form. Again, in terms of the holomorphic free form of the base, because I'm taking a Calabi-Yau twofold, so omega of the entire manifold is omega s, which theta. And it's easy to see, of course, that this omega is closed. So these are the constraints. So right now I only have imposed constraints coming from supersymmetry. But I have not imposed any constraints coming from anomaly cancellation condition. And as I mentioned a moment ago, anomaly cancellation condition imposes very strong constraints on my internal geometry. So let me summarize for you what are the constraints that I have before anomaly cancellation is imposed. And we will see that anomaly cancellation will solve for us each and every single one of the allowed degrees of freedom. So they are fixed for us. So before anomaly cancellation, first of all, so before imposing anomaly cancellation, point number one, I said the base can be either T4 or K3. I haven't imposed any constraints, so I just used their scalar form of my base, scalar holomorphic free form of my base. So base can be T4. And anomaly cancellation condition will kill one of them. Second, I didn't mention it, but this omega here, in order for the symmetric to be globally defined, this omega has to be in an integer cohomology. So what I know right now is that I do have, so omega belongs to the integral cohomology of the base. So that in principle, an infinite number of solutions for this omega are allowed. So what we will see that anomaly cancellation condition will impose constraints on the allowed values of omega, and it will restrict the values of omega. So I didn't use in any of these equations the dilaton. The dilaton is not constrained whatsoever in what I wrote down there, and we will see that anomaly cancellation constrains the value of the dilaton. So right now the dilaton is not fixed. So let me show you how anomaly cancellation condition gives us information of all these three conditions. Let us say this is rather important because it will show us that some manifolds are really excluded. Even though they satisfy supersymmetry, they will be excluded from anomaly cancellation condition. However, there's one thing that is important for this type of manifolds, that when one has a solution to to the supersymmetry constraints and anomaly cancellation condition, then it's immediately a solution to the equations of motion. So that is possible to show. But you have to impose anomaly cancellation condition.
I have another question about this. Yeah. Fiber. Is it fiber singular everywhere, anywhere, even though the total space is non-singular?
No.
The meter is singular?
No, it's not. It's not singular. Absolutely not. Why are you worried about singular fibers?
Well, it seems then that you wouldn't get a chiral spectrum for one thing. Essentially. I'm not worried about
The model that I'm going to present you has got zero number of generations. It's a toy model. I have to start somewhere. I don't have right now. So the goal is, so I'm right now taking a K3 base. You will see it's a K3 base. And the goal is to use as a base literal and the Lepetzky surface, which is why I started my talk with the work of Overud, who had the Lepetzky surfaces as a base. So right now this model is a toy model, but we need to study first, I need to understand first the features of this model in order to go later on for more complicated models. Yeah? Okay, so let me, let me show you why anomaly cancellation condition provides constraints on this. So let me write down anomaly cancellation one more time. So anomaly cancellation condition tells us, let me write this down. This way where I substituted the H shield. And let me just call this star for simplicity. So it's really, if you take the ansatz for the metrics that I wrote down at the beginning and you start evaluating this, it takes several pages, even if it doesn't look so terrible, it takes several pages. Look at the paper by Yao and Fu. It's really complicated to evaluate this, so let me just show you what the information is that we get out of this. After evaluating this trace of R, which R term, and the trace of F, which F term, and let me integrate over the whole six-dimensional manifold, J, which, star. So I just wedge this equation here. I integrate this over the whole six-dimensional internal manifold. And what I see is I get an equation which looks in the following way. So again, as I say, evaluate this. You have to look at the paper by Yao and Fu. Because it's really a rather lengthy computation. So what you get is an equation that looks in the following way. R is the curvature of the base. J is the emission form of the entire manifold. Now comes the part that we were careful, so not mess up with conventions. So we used now the mathematics conventions, where this one is anti-Hermitian, but we are careful not to mess up with this. So what I know is that this term here is bigger than zero. I know that this term here is bigger than zero. So this expression here is bigger than zero. So what do I conclude from there? What I conclude from there is that my base manifold cannot be T4, it has to be T3. Otherwise, the left-hand side of this equation vanishes. Okay? Next point is, what I can do is I can take, again, my anomaly cancellation condition, I can integrate over the internal, the base, over K3, and what I see is the following. So get an equation, again, I'll show you the intermediate step, first Pantagruel class of the Bindle. divided by 2 plus integral over k3 omega s squared plus omega a squared k squared divided by 2 is equal to 24. Where I've used the first metric in class of k3 is 48. So again, I know that this term here is positive. And what I see from here is, a moment ago I said I do have an infinite number of solutions. I only know that my omegas are in the integral cohomology. I do have, in principle, an infinite number of solutions for omega. However, since I know that this positive term here, so this term here is positive, has to be equal to 24, I see that anomaly cancellation condition imposes restrictions on the allowed values of omega. So we will see later on a particular example where we will determine the value of omega explicitly. And the constraint that I just wrote down here by integrating over k3 is exactly the constraint that Fu and Yao wrote down when they evaluated the anomaly cancellation condition, which is a highly nonlinear differential equation for the dilaton field with a source term. So let me write this in the following way. And the integrability condition in order for this equation to have a solution is precisely the topological constraint that I wrote down here. So let's have a look. So the differential equation that Fu and Yao look at, so let me not write this out because it's really a complicated thing. So psi is a source term. And let me just show you how this source term looks like. So psi is equal to 1 over alpha prime integral omega a squared plus omega a squared. That's precisely the term that I wrote down over there. And in order for this differential equation to have a solution, we do have an integrability condition, which tells us that the integral over psi, if v, has to be equal to 0. And this imposes that the differential equation that I wrote down is an elliptic equation. And we know that an elliptic equation as opposed to an hyperbolic equation has a finite number of solutions. Okay?
Can I ask a very embarrassing question?
Yes.
Back over here where you showed the basis k3,
yes.
Why does the positivity of the two terms imply the positivity of the... So why can't the second term be larger than the first?
This term is positive.
You're saying with the minus sign it's positive.
With the minus sign it's positive because we were careful. This forms an Hermitian.
Right.
But we were careful because we took the Yao and Fu conventions, but we were careful not to mess up. Your book is messed up. You changed the eyes. You changed the eyes.
Can I actually go back to an earlier question? This is the question of whether the T2 is everywhere non-singular.
Okay.
So I'm mapping it over to F theory in my own head.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of varying T2 as being, well, heterotic on T2 is well, F theory on T1. The T2 has no monotonies anywhere on the T3 base here.
Oh, but T2 has no monotonies.
What I understood from Alan was that the T2 doesn't actually vary.
It's just constant, yeah.
Yeah, it's a constant thing.
It's just K3 times T2?
No, it's not. It's
not metrically constant, but the complex structure of the T2.
The complex structure, absolutely. The complex structure is a constant.
So only
the
volume varies.
So the volume of it, what does that
mean? and not of the complex structure of the Fedez for Dirac quantization condition. The volume of K3 is a constant. You're asking me now a question that goes to model fields, something we're looking into right now, so whether it varies or not. So
there's that mixing term using the
Is to show you a solution to this equation. So, So what we can do is the following. So what are the omegas that are done here? Let's have a look at the anomaly cancellation condition. And let me show you our solution to this equation would look like. So suppose we do have a K3 base. Let me write down again the equation that I directed a moment ago, or that I wrote that a moment ago. So we do have an equation like this. Suppose I do have a solution where I would like to take a trivial GHP, then I would like to, I need to choose this omega s and this omega a precisely in such a way that I get a 24 on the right hand side. So what I can do is to take omega s. So first of all, the omega s, which is set ballpark, I can take to be proportional, let me take an integer, multiplied by the holomorphic 2 zero form of K3, then the omega I that I wrote down there, which is the anti-set dual part, will be a sum I equal to 19. We do have 19 anti-set dual forms on K3, so there will be a linear combination of them. I do have some integers here, multiplied by anti-set dual forms of K3. And you can actually, yep. I just said I would like to take a solution with trivial gauge fields. But in a moment I will mention the case where I don't have trivial gauge fields. So in that case you can look for particular configurations which satisfy this. So this is the case where it was just trivial gauge fields. Let me just note that. So you can find particular values of M and N that satisfy this. But for the case, so let me be a little bit more sketchy here because I still didn't arrive where I actually wanted to get. So this, let me take, if I take this spindle into account, the gauge field into account, what is possible to show is that all stable bundles of K3 live to stable bundles of the Hull manifold. Stable bundles on K3 have been studied by Mukai, so we know a great deal of them, so that we can construct the stable bundles on the Hull manifold. And so Let me not enter into more detail here. So we know how to construct the set of bundles. Our set of bundles of phase 3, we can lift them up. And they have been characterized by Mukai, so there are some equations that we will write them down that characterize the stable bundles of K3. And we can have stable bundles, SUN bundles. So, and as I mentioned at the beginning, so what we do have is some very, because I'm not embedding the spin into the gauge connection, I do have some rather interesting gauge symmetry patterns. So let me just mention the ones that I consider. So normally what we do is we just choose the sound embedding. The 8 goes to SU3 times 6. So, but we get some rather interesting gauge symmetry patterns. If we now, since I can choose SUN bundles, I can take an SU4, which is the case that Overt had, and take an SU4 times SO10, which are interesting gauge groups, SO10, or I can have an E8, which breaks to SU5, which is, by the way, a version that Donaghy and Bouchard had for the hydraulic model that I discussed at the beginning, times SU5. And as I say, these are rather interesting groups that are given grand unified theories. And as I said, if I was asking at the beginning, so in this construction, we don't have any 5 brains whatsoever, so I don't need to worry about stabilizing model diffusions of 5 brains. So you don't, you simply don't need it. And I think
the bundles on K3, however, have modular array.
The
bundles on K3 from the modulized basis that were discussed by Mukai, but does your lift into the bundle actually affect the K3 bundle moduli?
You're actually asking, I was going to mention a little bit about this, but that's work in progress. So everything that is moduli field, so let me maybe just mention, so that's work in progress right now with Yao and Zeng. So how do we characterize? So that's precisely what we are looking into. So what are the model fields of, how do we characterize model fields of these manifolds? And I think I kind of didn't get to the end of my talk, but so let's see. So what are model fields of non-Keeler manifold distortion? So that's a question that we have been asking ourselves for a long time. So what we have got is two things on the non-Keeler manifold distortion. First of all, we know that we have got a holomorphic freeform, which means we can have deformations, we can deform the holomorphic freeform, or we can have deformations of our Hermitian form. Okay, so we have got manifolds have got two things. We've got an omega and we've got an J. The reason why, so normally what we do is we derive the derivative equation by looking at the equations of motion, and then we derive equations for the model of heat. So what I would like to do, what we can do for the case where we look at supersymmetric deformations, is we will look at linear variations of this J. So let me preserve for now the complex structure. We will look for linear variations of J, where J goes to J plus delta J. And we will look for deformations that preserve, number one, our conformally balanced condition. Number two, so after evaluating this, we see that we get an infinite number of solutions to this equation. The infinite number of solutions to this equation here will be cut down by the anomaly cancellation condition, something that we are in the process of evaluating. And number three, we need to, of course, look at the solution to Hermitian Langmuir. And we hope to be done with the characterization, at least for the particular example. It's the equations that come out for the very general case look like very, very complicated equations. So, but for the particular example, we think we are able to evaluate what the model fields of the manifold are. I didn't get to the points that I was going to talk about, so let me just say a couple of words about this. So One way, so the goal is, of course, I introduced you to one particular example. The goal is to understand more examples of this type of manifolds. One way of doing this is through geometric transitions. So let me not elaborate on this. So geometric transitions in the context of the hydraulic theory is another aspect that is rather interesting to study. It maps one type of manifolds in one geometry to a different type of manifolds, but let me not enter into details of this discussion. So this would allow me to construct interesting gauge series, but at the same time, interesting torsional backgrounds. And the last point where I didn't get into is in when we have constructed all this, can we see something like this in an experiment, which is the other part or that we were looking into. So the question is, can we get inflation in the hydraulic theory? I like particularly the hydraulic theory because I always think, well, after reaching some point, you would like to have a standard model, which is why we are looking at the hydraulic theory. Or can we construct cosmic strings in this scenario? Homework is there need to be more people working on the subject because we cannot do everything at the same time. We need more people working in this. And that's it.
Strongly warped regions in these
classifications? Strongly warped regions, meaning?
The warp factor in front of the Minkowski part of the metric, does it get small anywhere?
You don't need to have, in general, they are not warped compactifications, except for the case when you are compactifying to the internal manifold is K3. So otherwise, they don't necessarily, they are not conformally Calabi-Yau. So. That's one.
The question would be whether it's conformally Calabi-Yau, whether it's warping in front of the four-dimensional coupling.
Whether there's warping in front of the four-dimensional part of the metric.
A warp factor. Mm-hmm.
Which is the dilaton.
No.
Yes, in the hydraulic, well, in the hydraulic theory, the warp factor is the dilaton, right?
This comes out of the equations.
It comes out of the equations. The warp factor is the dilaton, so you're asking me how does the dilaton look like, right? You're asking me to solve the second order differential equation. So I don't know. It's looking at the solution border to this equation.
But aren't they linking the ways that the string metric is flat in four dimensions?
The string metric is flat.
Because these are CFTs. These are CFTs, so translation errors feels free. So I think they're all string metrics, they're all flat.
So that's why the isometric
calculus precisely doesn't. Oh, so what you're asking is whether the space is factorized? That's the question? And I answer from the factorized and the string frame they don't. Or the other way around. One of both. And the other way around, yeah. One of both.
So when you use the phrase, I think you use the phrase determine the moduli, you meant to determine their values or you meant to?
Fix them in terms of fluxes. So I can of course not do more than people do in the type 2 theories where you fix them in terms of fluxes and then you have a landscape, which by the way also hasn't been studied. So the hydraulic landscape, I was trying to get Douglas and Dennis to work on it, but apparently they went into SOV, OSV, and they went into something completely different. So, but they promised to get back. So...